Hello there, and welcome back to the Root Cause Medicine Podcast. I'm your host for today, Dr. Kate Kresge, and we're talking about all things advanced immunology that you need to know if you're someone who's on the leading edge of treating patients with chronic illness or immune dysregulation. My expert today is Robin Puglia. She's a clinical nutritionist, IFM certified practitioner, and she has over 20 years experience educating providers in the space of immunology and complex chronic illness. She is also the vice president for practitioner education at Cyrex Labs. Cyrex has a really unique story. It was founded by Dr. Vojdani, a PhD who studies immunological dysfunction. And what he found was that there weren't enough clinical tests available to help practitioners who were really knowledgeable about immunology dive deeper into the potential dysfunctions and root causes of their patients' presentations. So he created a lab to help them do it. We talked through biomarkers today that you may not even know you're able to order for your complex clients. Things like tissue-specific autoimmunity that can screen for immunological dysfunction that shows up before ANA becomes dysfunctional. We also look at things like tissue transglutaminase 6, which detect neurological autoantibodies often associated with celiac disease, but not screened for with the typical tissue transglutaminase that we run when we're looking for frank celiac in the gut. Robin is the expert of experts. She's become the person that folks like me and people who do functional medicine like you send their patients to when we're stuck. And it's because she's seen it all. She walks us through the wide variety of tests that Cyrex offers that help us get to the next level. And I'll tell you, she does it in a fun and engaging way. I was hanging on her every word. I'm really honored to have Robin with us today. I think you're going to find her stories fascinating, memorable, and like me, you'll learn a lot about immunology and testing that you didn't know before you listened. Let's dive in. Before we get started, though, I've got a special question for the practitioners in the audience. Practitioners, what if your supplement dispensing, patient education, and treatment planning all lived in one powerful platform built for whole person care? And what if that platform was free for both you and your patients while saving you hours each week on treatment planning and follow-up? Well, meet FullScript, the comprehensive care delivery platform designed to reduce administrative burden and enhance clinical impact. From automated refills and lab ordering with interpretation, to evidence-based protocols and built-in adherence support, FullScript integrates the tools you need to streamline care and stay focused on what matters most, your patients. In a recent survey, 74% of providers reported saving up to 3 hours per week using FullScript to create their treatment plans. Are you ready to work smarter and elevate your practice? Visit FullScript.com to get started today. Robin Puglia, welcome to the Root Cause Medicine Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited and pleased to be here.
I am so excited as well. Robin has some beautiful watercolors of B cells and T cells behind her, which frankly, I wish I had in med school because I think it would have endeared me a little bit more to these cell types. The immunology was so complex. They're so beautiful. And no surprise that you have those behind you because you are one of the leading experts in immunology and autoimmunity. You teach, you're the VP of practitioner education at Cyrex Labs. Mm-hmm. And I am thrilled to have you on because I've been dying to educate our audience a little bit about who Cyrex is, why the lab was created, and why you guys are truly at the forefront when it comes to understanding how the immune system works so we can solve some of the most complex chronic illnesses we've got right now in our society. So I am so thrilled you're here.
Thank you. I'm really thrilled to be here. And I've got a lot to say about autoimmune disease, immune system dysfunction, but the T cells and the B cells are there because they're my besties. I spend all day, every day with them. And I mean, immunology is just a big love affair of mine, actually. And I really, it's very much changed understanding the immune system and the complexities and the gray areas has really radically changed my own clinical practice over the years. And Cyrex actually was instrumental to that. I actually have a joke that I make, which is that I talked about Cyrex so much that they gave me a job. You know, it wasn't, I didn't learn about the company because I was employed by them. I almost badgered them. I talked about them so much. Yeah.
That's the number one way to get hired somewhere. I mean, really, come on. Well, tell us though about your background, mm-hmm. you know, what your practice was like, and then how you found Cyrex and why it changed your practice so radically.
So I work in nutrition primarily and functional medicine. My practice is in the UK. And so back in 2009, 2010, I was really developing a strong focus on gluten-related disorders and celiac disease. So I had already started working with kind of complex cases, and autoimmunity was coming up frequently. But I just had this realization that I didn't understand extra-intestinal celiac disease almost at all. That was around 2009. And so back in the day, Jeff Bland used to send out these CDs, Functional Medicine Update, and he sent a CD that was focused on gluten reactivity and celiac disease. And they're really talking about the extra-intestinal manifestations of celiac disease. And so I did a really deep dive, started working with the celiac community, because there was just a huge number of people after diagnosis who were still struggling with their symptoms, who didn't feel well. Some of them actually felt significantly worse after going gluten-free and were really struggling. So I started working with that community. But I also then really realized that there was a large number of people, this is just in the UK, who were struggling to get a diagnosis at all, struggling to get a diagnosis in the first place, who were in this sort of prodromal period of really bad symptoms and life-changing health concerns, but that didn't fit cleanly into a diagnostic criteria. So then I also started working with them. I called that unexplained illness. So then Cyrex, I started using Cyrex testing. It must have been 2012. But I was using them in the US because they hadn't launched in the UK yet. And so that meant, this was so complicated, but if I was traveling to the US to come to a conference or to visit anybody, I would, the day before my flight, or sometimes the morning of my flight, I would get everybody who I wanted to test into the clinic, draw the blood, and then hop on the plane with all of their serum and then ship them to the lab from the US.
That is dedication.
And listen, there were some stories. Like one time I flew into Los Angeles and my suitcase didn't make it on the flight. And so I had this sort of lost suitcase situation with 30 people's serum in the suitcase. But so what I started learning then was that they didn't have such a wide suite of tests. So it was food reactivity and autoimmunity, was how many people, for example, were significantly gluten reactive, but didn't fit neatly into the celiac, you know, diagnostic criteria, or who had prodromal autoimmunity, but they hadn't yet reached the diagnostic criteria for the autoimmune disease that they had. And so having access to that information really changed my practice. It changed who I was able to help. It changed my understanding of food immunology and how food was interacting with people's immune systems for better or for worse. It allowed me to get answers for people who had been seeking answers, for women who had been seeking care from practitioner after practitioner, trying to understand why they didn't feel well, for people with celiac disease who didn't really understand the full landscape of what was going on with their nervous systems and their, you know, skin and other food reactions. And it was just, it really broadened the landscape of my practice and helped me help a lot of people. So then when Cyrex launched in the UK in 2013, they asked me to speak because I had all of these case studies and nobody else in the UK had the case studies. So I got up on stage and really presented some of the things that I had learned from working with Cyrex, and also some of the cases that had really, I mean, some of them were just such radical transformations because of the info that was in, you know, Cyrex RA3X at that time. Understanding, you know, non-celiac neurological autoimmunity was a lot of people that I was working with at that time. So then I became the UK and Europe head of clinical education for Cyrex, and I've been with them ever since. And more recently have broadened my scope with them to include the US as well as their head of education. But it really genuinely has come from how much I learned from Dr. Vojdani and from the other, you know, the head of medical education at that time, Tom Alexander, taught me so much. And then how I was able, but outside of all of that, because knowledge is one thing, but how it translates into clinical practice is the most important thing. And that was really the thing that I was the most excited about, and that I have the most fun teaching and supporting other practitioners with, because the science is, of course, amazing. But it has to translate into clinical practice in a way that is reproducible, in a way that is trustworthy. And I think that is really it's why I'm still with them 13 years later, and why I remain so, you know, so deeply invested in the work that we're doing together. Yeah.
Yes. I love everything you just said. We were talking right before I hit record about, I think it's really important for practitioners to understand why a lab was founded, because there's often a really interesting story there. Mm-hmm. It is not an easy thing to start a laboratory. It is not an easy thing to get a laboratory developed, test approved. And the reason that people do it is generally because they see a clinical need. The research is out there about the biomarkers that we can be measuring to tell us more about what we need to do to help a patient, but nobody's offering them. And so we've got these real revolutionaries on the forefront of these labs who just decide, I'm going to do it. I'm going to offer this type of testing because I know it's going to make a difference for patients. And they're usually the ones that are the most knowledgeable about the tests that are being developed, and they end up teaching other practitioners. And that's how a lot of the companies that folks will see in the Fullscript catalog and the Rupa Health catalog have evolved. But it's hard to convey that story when someone's just searching for it through a catalog and trying to find an answer for their patient.
Yeah.
But I love the chance to dive into those stories, because I think it's really important that practitioners have that context. So we're going to get into how and why Cyrex was founded and by who and where you guys, how you've evolved. But I want to take a step back and actually talk about the clinical impact and the clinical implications of what you were just talking about. You're talking about these tests and you're naming out, okay, this array made a difference. What were you actually able to measure with Cyrex that you couldn't measure at the time that was so revolutionary?
That's such a great question. So the first one that I think is still so important, that still is really fundamental to my practice to this day, is actually tissue transglutaminase 6 and also transglutaminase 3. So within a conventional celiac panel, we look at transglutaminase 2, which is an autoantibody associated with the characteristic damage to the villi of the small intestine in celiac disease. But actually, the medical literature, again, going back 30 years, really quite explicitly states that celiac disease and more broadly gluten sensitivity is not primarily a disease of the gut or of the small intestine. It was actually reclassified as a systemic autoimmune disease. And the number one organ system that is affected by gluten-mediated immune reactivity is the brain and the nervous system. So transglutaminase 6 is an autoantibody specific to the cerebellum of the brain. It's from the Purkinje cells in the cerebellum, and it is gluten reactive. It cross-reacts with gliadin in the same way that transglutaminase 2 does for the guts. And it can be found in somebody with celiac disease, but it can also be found independently of celiac disease. And again, Marios Hadjivassiliou from the University of Sheffield in the UK has been publishing about transglutaminase 6 for more than 30 years. And to this day, it's still only available in a research setting. Until Dr. Vojdani, who of course, you know, not just reads, but also publishes and is very involved with the autoimmunology medical literature, realized the clinical applicability of that marker and how important it was going to be for people who didn't fit the criteria of celiac disease, but were experiencing significant neurological symptoms, ataxia, peripheral neuropathy, depression, anxiety. It's associated with ADHD, worsening patterns of symptoms, migraines, sometimes even epilepsy. There's such a broad range of significant clinical presentations that it's directly related to. And if that person wasn't celiac or didn't display any of the GI symptoms, which many celiacs do, actually the majority of people with celiac disease do not, they weren't being tested, they weren't being recognized. And if they tested negative for celiac disease, then they were told that they were fine to eat gluten, even though it is a direct driver of neurological autoimmunity and of not just neurological autoimmunity, of loss of quality of life, of distress, of pain, of all of the ways that that kind of neurological presentation or any type of chronic illness affects the entire family. So he made it commercially available. He included it in Cyrex RA3X, which is now called Wheat Burden. And it has been available for clinical practice, for those of us who are using the panel. And it was one of the things that helped me join the dots between, you know, food and food immunology and the symptoms that people had been suffering with, but also failing to get answers for. So that's, it's one that I think is really fundamentally important. But additionally, actually, there's a range of other peptides and proteins associated with wheat and gluten that aren't really tested for either in the celiac disease panels or in the sort of broader food immune reactivity panels, where they're just looking at maybe whole wheat and maybe 33-mer alpha-gliadin, which is our kind of gluten peptide or gluten protein. But in fact, wheat is a complex food. It is made up of a wide range of proteins, and including gluten itself, which is several hundred amino acids in length, and which breaks down into more than 100 different peptide fragments, of which roughly 60% are capable of eliciting an adaptive immune response. So, and people with celiac disease, people with non-celiac wheat and gluten reactivity can be reacting to any of those immunogenic proteins or peptides associated with wheat and gluten, but not, you know, the sort of 33-mer traditional protein or whole wheat. So RA3 also has expanded out to include the most immunogenic peptides and proteins so that we can get a proper look at whether or not somebody is or isn't wheat and gluten reactive. And I have so many cases actually where people have done a food reactivity test or a celiac test and it's been negative for wheat, negative for gluten, negative for celiac disease. And then when we've run RA3 or wheat burden, they've been profoundly wheat and gluten reactive and autoimmune as a result of their wheat and gluten reactivity, but it was missed because the, you know, other available panels were too narrow or maybe didn't have the right, you know, didn't include IgA antibodies, which is another feature of the Cyrex panels, is that we're looking at IgG and IgA, not just IgG. So the aim, you know, Dr. Vojdani's aim really, and he's continued to evolve the panel. He is obviously our immunologist and the chief science officer for Cyrex. He's continued to evolve the panel over time. We've just updated it this year as well, as our understanding around food immune reactivity continues to evolve and change. And his whole raison d'etre around it is to avoid false negatives. We don't want false positives either, but we want to make sure that we're not missing those people who are falling through the cracks of what else was available. That's really how and why he developed Cyrex in the first place, was, like you say, is he really saw a need and a population of people who were suffering because they were falling through the cracks of what was already available. And he stepped up. He understood the science, the medical literature, the immunology, the microbiology as well, but really understood how to translate that into what was needed for our clinical practices so that we could be in service to the population of people who actually need that medicine, that information.
You're going right where I wanted to go next, which was like how Cyrex came to be. So we both know Dr. Vojdani. I think anyone who has learned about immunology in the functional medicine space probably knows his name, has seen his face, and now his son as well. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us the story of Cyrex? Like, let's dive in here a little bit.
So, you know, there's a saying, something about, you know, standing on the shoulders of giants. Actually, should probably learn the full saying, but you know, Dr. Vojdani really is one of the Dr. Bland, Dr. Vojdani, they're two of the giants whose shoulders we stand on, whether or not we realize it, yes or no. They're two people who have, whose work and whose passion and dedication have really fundamentally changed not just our industry, but the global conversation around health, the global conversation about autoimmune disease in clinical practice. So Dr. Vojdani is a fascinating scientist and he's beloved in the industry. You know, you don't meet people who have anything bad to say about him for the most part. Everyone just is like, he is fascinating, a genius, you know. And all of that, of course, is true, but he's also a passionate teacher. And that comes across so clearly. He spends so much time with practitioners, making sure that they are comfortable and confident and understand the science and how to apply the science and the testing. His background is immunology and microbiology. And he is a conventional scientist, you know, so he was raised up through laboratory science and medicine with a really conventional background. But the way that he thinks about the human body, about the immunology, is fundamentally very forward thinking. He has a real way of understanding and looking at the landscape, not just for what exists now, but for what is needed for the future. And a really big part of that, he's got two things that I think make Cyrex part of what the lab is today. And that is, number one, his primary motivation is to be in service to the patient population. So he's not just doing science for the love of science, which there's not a criticism involved in that. We do love a scientist, but he has this additional ability to understand the context of science being translated into clinical practice through the lens of the clinician in order to be in service of the people. And so he understands what it means for a grandma to not have joint pain anymore, and or for a mother to have enough energy and to not be getting migraines, and what that means for the family. And so he always has that in his peripheral vision, or maybe even in the forefront of his vision, when he is thinking about the research that he's doing and what does that mean for not just the practitioners who are working with the science and with the tests, but also how does that translate into changing the lives of the people who are in need. So we've got that real, he has that ability to hold all of those in the same lens. What is the science, and where is the science going? Also, what does that mean for the practitioners? And then how does that translate through into the clinical practice of the patients, which of course is what all of the practitioners are in service for as well. You know, that's, we're always holding the space for, listen, this is a fascinating test, but what does this information mean for the person I have sitting in front of me? How am I going to use it to inform my intervention strategy and make sure that what I'm doing is effective, what I'm doing is purposeful, what I'm doing is able to actually change the trajectory of health for this human that I'm working with, not just because the science is interesting. Yeah.
I think it's so critical. I remember this was like 2008. I remember I have a type of celiac that is not typical. And I remember being on PubMed late at night, just thinking, I need to just go see a PhD who's writing about all of this and like get them to tell me who I can get to test me for this stuff. Which most of you, if you're someone with like a weird unexplained illness and you're also a PubMed warrior, you know this feeling of like, why can't I get an MD to test me for this stuff? Do I have to go to a PhD whose papers I'm reading and somehow get them to help me check my blood for all this stuff that they're writing about that is so profound and clearly like, you know, needs to be a part of the workup for people like me. And it's part of what made me decide to become a clinician instead of going to become a PhD, because I thought, I want to always be able to help people do something with the literature that's coming out. And maybe I just need to be one of those people who's able to use my license to order the test that I know needs to be ordered. But you can't do that if the test doesn't exist. And so we've all benefited from Dr. Boshani going and making sure the test is even available. So it's incredible. You've mentioned some of the subtypes of gluten reactivity that you're able to pick up with these tests that are not part of standard workup. What are some of the other panels and biomarkers that are available through Cyrex that are not available through other labs that are really making a difference for patients?
So I think actually our food reactivity panel, so food reactivity is a global industry. There are so many panels and every panel has its own, you know, unique characteristics because and some of them just contain a really wide range of foods. Some of them include other immune markers, complement or are IgE and IgG. And so globally, there is a really wide number of food reactivity panels, but Cyrex is the only one that actually looks at cooked versus raw food. And The reason for that, again, is because Dr. Vashtang, from the medical literature, so reading other people's work and understood that it was important, and then went and reproduced the work and worked out what that would mean for the individual, looked at how the immunogenicity of food radically changes when you process or change or transform the food, especially using heat. Now, so we know that the way a protein folds, or the immunogenicity or allergenicity of a protein really changes whether or not the protein is in its primary form, which is raw, secondary form, where it has undergone some degree of transformation, or tertiary form, where it has been cooked or heated past a particular point. And so if you are never eating raw chicken, why would we ever test raw chicken if when you cook it, the immune relationship with that protein is completely different? And this is also true for wheat, you know, so gluten and wheat is generally tested in its raw form. And that's important because gluten doesn't break down with heat processing. It does change with digestion because it's cleaved into these sort of immunogenic, antigenic proteins. It is transformed into these antigenic peptide fragments by the digestive system, but not radically transformed. However, wheat changes really significantly from its raw form through to dough. So when we mix flour, which is raw ground, raw milled wheat, with water to make dough, is actually when we activate gluten. So the gliadin and glutenin are transformed into gluten in that proving process where the water is mixed. That's why flour is not stretchy by itself, but when we mix the water, the dough becomes elastic and stretchy. That's because gluten has been activated, enzymatically activated by the water. And most of us also don't really eat a lot of dough by itself. What we then do is we eat pasta, which is cooked, and bread, which is cooked. And nobody that I know is having a quick teaspoon of flour in the kitchen, you know, you know, in between Zoom calls. So understanding the immunology of gluten reactivity doesn't change whether or not gluten is raw or cooked. But actually, we're not eating raw flour. So we also need to be testing cooked wheat products, because there is a number of people who don't react to gluten but are extremely immune sensitized to the cooked form of wheat once it's undergone that the transformation of the heating and the cooking process. But this is also true for a wide range of other foods. So Cyrex's food reactivity panels are really put together to, as accurately as we possibly can, reflect, use the test to reflect the real life immunology of how we eat food and how the immune system interacts with that food. So we test grapes, but we also test wine, because once we've fermented the grape, the immunogenicity is different. We test salmon raw, but we also test it cooked, because we eat sushi and sashimi, but we also eat it baked. But we're never testing raw bacon or raw pork or raw chicken or any of the other, you know, any of the other foods solely raw if we're not also eating them raw. And I think that that is something that has, so that allows us two big things. Number one, we're not taking away foods that are nourishing and nutritionally important. We're not inflicting is the wrong word, but we're not imposing restriction unnecessarily on people, understanding the psychological and emotional impact of doing that. But additionally, we're not allowing people to eat food that is driving a really significant inflammatory immune process in the body, because we got a false positive or a false negative based on raw results versus cooked results. So that's something that isn't really available anywhere else. And it is astonishing to me that is a known, we know with allergy literature that children with egg allergy are sometimes told that they're okay to eat baked eggs. So, and this has been because we know that once you properly fully cook an egg for the 45 minutes that it's baking in the oven, that it isn't allergenic anymore. So this is a known entity in allergy. It's a known entity in immunology, but that hasn't been translated through into food reactivity. So that's a really important one. Array 5 is another, for me, it's such a radical, a radically obvious panel. So RA5 is our tissue-specific autoantibody panel. So it contains 24 of the most common tissue-specific autoantibodies. So it's not a rheumatology panel. It doesn't include ANA or ENA or the double-stranded DNA antibodies. Those are widely and easily available. But it contains the most common tissue-specific antibodies, and it is also a predictive antibody panel. So it's helping us to identify autoimmunity in the prodromal period, not only until somebody meets or the person meets the diagnostic criteria. So we know that the prodromal period for autoimmune disease is somewhere between 5 and 20 years, where autoantibodies are detectable, but the tissue destruction and the degradation and the organ function hasn't been affected enough that it now meets the sort of diagnostic criteria. But those people have significant symptoms of inflammation, immune system dysregulation, fatigue, pain, skin rashes, you know, all kinds of symptoms that are associated with the development of autoimmunity, or just with having very poor tolerance, loss of tolerance, significant immune system dysregulation. These are the women, you know, also men, but of course, autoimmunity affects 80% women who are seeking care, seeking their seeking out their primary care physician, asking for help because they are suffering and repeatedly being told there isn't anything wrong with you, your labs are normal. Try HRT, try the birth control pill, try antidepressants, or you need to just relax, whatever it is. So having that panel allows for an easy way to test for the most common culprits around tissue-specific autoimmunity. This is also really important for anybody with a diagnosed autoimmune disease because polyautoimmunity affects 1 in 4 people with autoimmune disease across all of the autoimmunities. For celiac disease, it's 1 in 3. And then there are some autoimmunities, such as the hepatic autoimmunities, where the numbers are actually almost 50%, like 48% of people with a hepatic some of the hepatic autoimmunities will have polyautoimmunity. But again, they're not necessarily diagnosable at the same time. So it's important once somebody at time of diagnosis or at the time that you start working with them, if they have an existing diagnosis, even if things seem well, to assess for prodromal autoimmunity or polyautoimmunity against other organs and tissue types. And so that's RA5. We also have lymphocyte map, which has been just, again, as sort of another level of transformation for my own clinical practice, has been really understanding how really getting to know the language of the lymphocytes has been able to really, not transform is the wrong word, direct, focus my clinical intervention strategy in a complex case. So in the world of long COVID, post-infectious autoimmunity, mold and Lyme, the sort of complex cases that we are all working with more and more in this day and age, being able to really have a conversation with the immune system about what's going on has been able to direct my focus in a way that saves us all a lot of time and a lot of trial and error, which of course is important for the person, the patient who has the complex case, and also money, because it means I'm not casting such a wide net around testing. I can really understand where to direct my energy and my focus in clinical practice. So I don't think, some of the Quest and LabCorp have some lymphocyte profiles, but they're not as comprehensive. And they just don't paint the same picture in the same way as the lymphocyte map does.
Let's take a step back and talk about what lymphocytes are, what the lymphocyte map is measuring, and why it matters clinically.
Lymphocytes are the warriors, part of the warrior family of the immune system. They're part of the adaptive immune system, although we're also measuring natural killer cells, which are part of the innate immune system. So on the lymphocyte map, we've got the first two markers are actually total white cell count and total lymphocytes. And those markers are important because they give us context for understanding whether or not this immune system is resourced appropriately for the work that we see illustrated in the rest of the panel. But then we're looking at T cells, B cells, the T helper subtypes and their ratios, the T and B cell ratio. We look at CD4, CD8 ratio. And then we also look at quite a wide range of natural killer cells, natural killer T cells, total natural killer cells, and then some of our terminally differentiated natural killer cells with the CD57 receptor on them. So when you first see a lymphocyte map, especially if you've done the test on somebody who's quite a complex case, it can actually be a little bit overwhelming, maybe even a little bit intimidating. You feel like you need to know the immunology at an immunologist level. But actually, it's a conversation. So the immune system is a system of communication. It is responding to the environment, but also to the tissues and the biology of the body. And it works almost entirely on memory and pattern recognition. And do you know who else works on pattern recognition? Is doctors and functional medicine practitioners. So the lymphocyte map for me tells me three things that I think are really important and that really direct my clinical practice. And once you, the new practitioner who's new to this test, have seen, I would say, five of them, your pattern recognition develops really quickly. And what that body is telling you jumps off the page really quickly. So the first is, what is this immune system responding to, right? Which chess pieces are on the board here? Because which cell populations have been called into play tells us something about the upstream messaging for that cell type. So we know that T helper 1 cells, for example, are responding to intracellular pathogens such as viruses or some bacteria. We know that Th2 populations will be responding to yeast and fungi, to allergies, or to parasites. We know Th17 is the guardian of our mucosal surfaces, very involved with autoimmune disease, but also works with neutrophils to govern the microbiomes and our hollow spaces. So if we're seeing elevations there, then we know to think about the lungs, the urinary tract, the small intestine, you know, where is there an antigen breach on those barriers that has called this cell population into play? So the first is, who's there? And once we see who's there, we have some idea about what the messaging has been from the environment or from the body that has allowed that to be the one called into action. The second thing that I'm asking, though, is this an appropriate response, yes or no? So if I'm seeing something like CD8 elevation, Th1 elevation, maybe some natural killer cell elevation, that's a really classic viral response. That's an appropriate response. I don't want to push any of those immune cells back into normal. I can see the immune system is appropriately fighting a virus. My job as the clinician then is to help it fight the virus. So I can provide antiviral immunomodulation, or I can use antivirals to help to reduce the antigen burden and to support resolution of the viral exposure. So that helps me see that this is an appropriate response, and then I can direct my clinical practice to help the immune system finish the work that it's doing. I'm not trying to outsmart it. The second part of that then becomes, what is preventing the immune system from achieving resolution? So is there immune suppression where I'm seeing below range numbers of some of the cell populations, which means that the immune system doesn't have the resources to do the work that's required? Or am I seeing immune exhaustion where the immune system is so upregulated, it's had so much antigen exposure that it is throwing everything that it possibly can at what it's trying to deal with, but not being effective, not managing to achieve resolution, even though it is really working very hard? So I think that the words exhaustion and suppression sound quite similar to each other. And in some cases of exhaustion, we see some of the cell populations that fall into suppression. But actually, the needs of the body in those two clinical scenarios are really different. So an immune system that is has some degree of suppression, first of all, we need to work out why. Are they on immunosuppressive meds? Have they had a toxic exposure? Is this a feature of a chronic virus? But the needs of that immune system are for stimulation, right? We actually need to stimulate that immune system in order to help it recover so that it has the resources needed to do the work. But an exhausted immune system where we might have co-polarized Th1, Th2, and Th17, where we've got all manner of natural killer cells, where the immune system has called everything into play and not been effective, that is an immune system that has very low capacity for stimulation. That's an immune system that requires stabilization. And that's how people who really, they're reacting to every intervention strategy that we try, they react to supplements, they might have a lot of mast cell reactivity, because when we have all of those adaptive immune responses and the natural killer cells going at the same time, if they're not effective, we have a larger reliance on the innate immune system, mast cells, neutrophils, which are of course non-specifically inflammatory. So we just have this kind of cacophony of immune response. That's an immune system that needs calming and a body that needs stabilization. So is it appropriate? Yes or no? What's preventing resolution? Is it exhaustion? Is it suppression? And then how do I work with the body in order to help the immune system recover and have competence? Because it's really about immune competence, actually. So how do I support immune competence for this person? Yeah.
Okay. I'm so locked into this conversation. This is so great. We need to have
a lot of information in a really small amount of time.
I love it. We need to have you teaching for us more. You mentioned, could they have a suppressed immune system due to a toxic exposure? What type of toxic exposure could do that?
Mold can definitely do that, especially with prolonged exposure. Other environmental toxins, people that are working, people who are firemen, wives of firemen, or family members of firemen who are being exposed to a large number of flame retardants and chemicals, either from the work that they're doing or from the exposure to the like washing the clothes in the family washing machine. Actually, a population of people who I've seen this in repeatedly is veterans, where they have been called into service and have had a wide range of exposures that I actually couldn't even begin to guess at, and have significant suppression as a result of that experience. Those are some of the big ones that really spring to mind.
And if someone has had one of those, it seems like you've been able to help them. Is there hope for them that they can kind of heal from that exposure and get their immune system working well again?
So the answer to that is yes. It's really important. And I guess this is a very naturopathic principle, is that the body really has the innate ability to heal and recover, that it will always work towards improved function if it has the environment and the resources to do that. And so with autoimmunity, with a complex case, with complex trauma, and that sort of, the veterans, of course, there's a lot of jigsaw puzzle pieces in a situation like that. And I think it's incredibly important to hold two things at the same time. So the first is the importance for hope and the belief that you can be better and that things can improve, and that year upon year, that each year can be fundamentally better than the one before it, and the realistic expectation of how long it might take, and that we're not necessarily talking about achieving 100% health in the way that somebody might have had when they were 19 years old. But that, but again, that forward trajectory of health is, I've never worked with anybody where that wasn't possible, I don't think. In some cases it just takes a lot longer and it requires a slower, steadier trajectory and a lot of holding of the emotional space around what it means to heal and recover.
What types of interventions would you use for someone like that, aside from trying to reduce exposure and clean up the environment if possible? Are you giving them like nutrients, herbs, like what's in the toolkit?
Okay, so I'm going to tell you a story. I read a story about the British cycling team that really radically changed my practice. Now, I have almost zero interest in cycling. I don't think I've ever watched a cycling event, not even in the Olympics. So the British cycling team were absolutely not on my radar. Turns out they had a terrible cycling team. They were like a joke in the cycling world. Yeah. And they also had no money because they couldn't get any sponsors. So they ended up hiring a manager, or I don't know what the director of a cycling team is called, a coach, I guess, but hiring this man who had no budget for buying, you know, space age bicycles, and so who had to think about things differently. And what he did was he decided that he was going to work with aggregate gain, and that he was going to try to make a 1% change in as many different variables as was possible for him. So he worked on the friction, you know, which lotion can we use to improve friction being caused by the motion of cycling? What about sleep? Who's using what pillow? What about the way that they're breathing? Anything that he could think of. What about, you know, meal timings and just all of the things that probably seem quite obvious if you're working in functional medicine, but he was limited with his resources and he wasn't aiming for you know, the best of anything. He was just like, how can I improve as many things as possible? And he had a goal, and he had a 5-year plan for this goal. He wanted to achieve a particular goal within 5 years. And he not only achieved it, but he dramatically exceeded it within 3 years or something because of this theory of aggregate gains. And I read that and I was like, I can also do that with the body. I can do that with the body. And so with the immune system and with a chronic illness as well, there are three things that I'm thinking about. So the first is, what are the direct drivers, let's say, of autoimmunity? So you and I, we both have celiac disease or a version of celiac disease. We cannot eat gluten, but gluten is a specific driver for us. There are people who can eat gluten and not only not have a reaction to it, but have it improve their microbiome. So for them, gluten is not an issue at all. So I'm always trying to understand, what are the specific drivers for this individual? And can I do something about that? You know, the functional medicine principles of what needs to be removed because it's getting in the way of health, what needs to be replaced because it is needed for health and it is in inadequate quantities in this person's body or their life. So direct drivers. Then I'm also thinking about, what are the indirect drivers? What are the non-specific drivers of inflammation? And by indirect and non-specific, I mean, it's always true for everybody. So being underslept, which is, by the way, 7 hours or less is underslept, is always slightly pro-inflammatory or significantly pro-inflammatory. Overtraining, sedentary behavior, dysglycemia, hormone dysregulation, poor biotransformation and elimination, all of these things are always inflammatory, always dysregulatory. They might not be obviously connected to the goals of the person or to the diagnosis of the person. But if I can assess that I can improve something in that region, then I know that that is going to have a positive impact on everything that they are trying to achieve and everything that they are trying to improve. And then the last piece of that is, do I have the control? Do we have control over this? Do we have the ability to change it? Yes or no? Because I'm not. So for a mother who is a single mother, who is working full time and who has two children with significant additional needs, right? Talking to her about stress or sleep, maybe these are not variables that we have a lot of control over. So then where are my levers for change for them? And so for a really complex case, for somebody with, you know, for a veteran, for example, you know, who has really significant immune system suppression, I'm looking to understand, first of all, how can I influence the suppression? There's a lot of that is really directly nutritional. So zinc, for example, some of the medicinal mushrooms have a really significant ability to immunomodulate. Some of the zinc, selenium, vitamin A, all really required, sometimes at quite high doses in immune suppression. And we can use, you know, other strategies for immunomodulation that will help to improve and to stimulate the immune system for that person. Some of it is going to be about, what do we need to remove? So, you know, significant toxic exposure, you need to be helping that body not just bind and eliminate the exposure that is current, but additionally to safely and effectively be able to mobilize the body burden and to so mobilize transport, biotransform, and elimination toxic exposures, which can take a long time, right? A proper detox strategy can be 2 years or even longer before we really are able to significantly reduce that burden for that body. Points of leverage. Not necessarily going to be talking about the things that we can't change. I'm going to really focus on what we do have the ability to change and how aggregate gain of changing as many things that we have the ability to do has such a strong power to really, again, change the trajectory, first in ways that might be subtle, but over time, especially as we start to accumulate the gains of all of those changes, to really radically change someone's life in a period of time.
I love that story about aggregate gain. I will never forget that. That's a great story. The cycling team. Wow. It's so true. It's such a beautiful approach. I'm wondering about the other panel Cyrex has. We've talked a lot about lymphocytes. We've talked a lot about food reactivity. What are some of the other panels that clinicians may not be familiar with that you find make a big difference? Or you think, thank God Cyrex has this available. I can't find it anywhere else.
Blood-brain barrier permeability is a really big one. So the Cyrex panel, Cyrex has a system for the tests that that they have in their suite. So that system is essentially this kind of three pieces to that. So the first one is looking at the immune system directly. So we've got the lymphocyte map, which really helps us to do that. The second one is autoantibodies. So is this autoimmune, yes or no? What is the target tissue for the autoimmune process? So we have RA5. We've also got a cognitive decline, so a quite deep dive into the neurological autoimmunity of cognitive health. We have a mucosal immune panel, which really looks at the origins of immune reactivity in the gut, and that includes some enteric nervous system autoantibodies. We have RA3, which of course includes the transglutaminases. So the autoimmune aspect to the testing suite. And then included in that, I guess, we also have a range of barrier permeability panels. So we have three barrier permeability panels in our bundle. We've got RA2, which is our gut permeability panel, and that includes lipopolysaccharides. And the reason that it has LPS antibodies in it is because we don't just want to know that there is barrier permeability. We also want to understand the immune consequences of that permeability. Do we need to just support the gut wall and have healthy cell turnover there, or do we need repair to the gut wall because there is injury, such as undiagnosed celiac disease or a stomach ulcer, something like that? And also, do we need to add in systemic immune modulation? So if we have LPS antibodies, then we know that that upregulates TLR4 and creates this big inflammatory cascade of events that lasts for weeks, if not months, longer than the actual LPS in the system. And so that is just a really comprehensive way of understanding the systemic impact and also what's required from intervention strategy. Do we need to investigate undiagnosed gut autoimmunity, just for example, or understand why the injury is occurring? But then the final piece of, there's two other panels in the bundle. One of those is actually called the SIBO and IBS panel, and that's looking at cytoskeletal proteins and also bacterial toxins from post-infectious IBS, traveler's diarrhea, or post-infectious SIBO. So has the exposure to that infection created a long-lasting immune system dysregulation specific to the gut, but additionally, has it initiated autoimmunity of the gut wall itself? So that looks at proteins found in the adherens junction, which sits just below the tight junction and is really responsible for maintaining integrity of the gut wall itself, but additionally very involved in the gut-brain axis. The last piece of that is blood-brain barrier permeability. And when we're looking at blood-brain barrier permeability, we're measuring antibodies to astrocyte foot protein in the systemic circulation. So that's important to understand because a lot of people, and this was also me for a really long time, we know that the gut and brain influence each other. We talk about the gut-brain axis all the time. And we also talk about the similarities that the endothelial tight junctions of the blood-brain barrier are regulated by, guess what, zonulin, occludin, claudins. And so there is this idea that if you know somebody has got gut permeability, that you can address their blood-brain barrier permeability by just supporting the gut wall, that when you close the gut wall or heal the gut wall, that that will also heal the blood-brain barrier. And that all of the things that we do that influence zonulin and those occludins and claudins and those tight junctions will have a positive impact on also the endothelial tight junctions. And that's not incorrect. And by the way, we also find those tight junctions in the biliary tract, in the lung mucosa, in the genitourinary tract, right? So anything that we do that positively influences them has a beneficial systemic impact. But the blood-brain barrier has got three layers. So we've got that endothelial tight junction is the first layer. Around the capillary, we have a pericyte. I have to be careful about my pronunciation of that word. It's not a parasite, it's a pericyte. And then above that is the astrocyte foot. So by the time we're measuring blood-brain barrier permeability in the systemic circulation, what we're actually looking at is neurological damage. It is an injury to the innermost layer of the blood-brain barrier. So it actually requires not just tight junction restoration, but additionally neurological tissue repair. And the blood-brain barrier markers, antibodies to the blood-brain barrier in the systemic circulation is also prognostic. So it really helps us understand the path that that person is on if nothing changes. And it's prognostic for long COVID. It's prognostic for post-viral fatigue syndromes and also for neurological autoimmunity. It helps us track and understand if the interventions that we're making are having a beneficial impact or not, but also to really understand the landscape of what we're working with. It's a really different, it is a one marker. It's a really simple test because we just that blood-brain barrier panel, which is ARI-20, is a single marker, blood-brain barrier protein, and three antibodies, IgG, IgA, IgM. But there's so much clinical guidance in that one little test. So barriers. And then lastly, we've got our environmental drivers of immune system dysregulation. So there are four categories of environmental driver. So those four categories are foods, infections, toxins, and stress. So stress chemistry specifically. Now, we are a functional immunology lab and you don't make antibodies to cortisol. So we don't do anything around stress specifically, but we have a really comprehensive suite of panels that look at the environmental drivers of loss of tolerance, immune system dysregulation, and autoimmune disease within those three categories. So foods, infections, toxins.
Beautiful. This is such a comprehensive suite of tests. You really could just like stick with Cyrex and probably understand most complex chronic illness. Let me take a step back. You said something like you're talking about astrocytes and how you'd want to focus on things beyond barrier repair if you see that come back with a clinically significant finding. What types of interventions are you talking about there? Is it like metabolic health for the brain? Is it CoQ10? Like, what should come to someone's mind beyond like, I'm going to heal the gut blood barrier and therefore influence the blood brain barrier? What else would come up as interventions that they may not otherwise consider?
Yeah, there's four prongs to that in my experience. So the first is vascular. So when we're talking about the blood-brain barrier, we're talking about a really huge vascular capillary network. So not just the tight junctions, but additionally the vascular health itself. So working out whether or not there is the microclots that may or may not be available, but also may or may not be relevant to this case. in a post-infectious case, but additionally vascular support. So vitamin C, bioflavonoids, polyphenols such as rutin, blood pressure intervention. So making sure somebody has adequate blood pressure if it's low, or intervention strategy that brings down blood pressure if somebody has got high blood pressure and it is unregulated and causing stress for the capillary. The second is neurological anti-inflammatory interventions. Curcumin, resveratrol, glutathione, things that dampen down and support the microglia of the brain and the inflammatory cascade that has occurred because of the breach, so calming down the inflammation. The third is neurological tissue repair. So for neurological tissue repair, I'm leaning quite heavily on two big things. So the first is actually alpha-lipoic acid. Alpha-lipoic acid we use for things like diabetic retinopathy, but the medical literature really shows us that it's helpful for things like multiple sclerosis where there's been demyelination, and for a really broad range of neurological, inflammatory, and kind of destructive processes. So alpha-lipoic, and alpha-lipoic multitasks like crazy for the brain and for blood-brain barrier, just so many things. It supports mitochondria, which is the final piece of the jigsaw puzzle. It supports the capillary network. It is antioxidant. It does so many things, but for tissue repair specifically. And then I really love herbs. So something like a Chinese skullcap, which again is a good multitasker. But when I'm thinking about actual tissue repair of the neurological tissue, those are the two, or a sort of broader range of herbs that spring to mind, depending on what's appropriate for the person. And then the final piece of that is immunometabolic. So any inflammation of the brain is going to have affected the mitochondria of the brain and of the nervous system tissue. So alpha-lipoic acid helps with that. Of course, glutathione helps with that. But we need to make sure that has been at least assessed, resolved, and supported as well.
So Robin, I can hear our audience thinking, how do I get more of Robin's time and teaching? And so I'm curious if you can tell folks, where can they find you? What are you hosting office hours and Q&As? Are you doing clinical consults? Like, how can people learn from you?
Well, so I'm the head of clinical education for Cyrex Labs. So my whole role with them is really around supporting the practitioner in understanding complex cases and how to work with complex cases in clinical practice, how to choose testing, how to understand what we're asking of the body, how to understand what we're asking of the test results, how to hold the complexity of a complex case, how to understand the immune system in the context of that case. So first port of call for sure, especially if you're in the US, is find me via Cyrex. I've done a really wide range of webinars and videos for them. But of course, people can actually also book in with me directly for a call or a clinical consult. So you can contact Cyrex for that. I also run, every year, I run a practitioner mentoring program called the Autoimmune Academy. And that runs through the calendar year. So if you would really like to do a deeper dive and spend 60 hours with me on talking about all of the things, that is another place that you can definitely find me.
And is there a website for each of those?
So cyrexlabs.com. And Cyrex is available through Rupa and Fullscript, but you can also reach out directly to Cyrex through cyrexlabs.com or through your reps. We have a fantastic range of reps who are super supportive and also themselves a real tour de force around education and very supportive for everybody's clinical practice. So I would encourage you, if you haven't reached out to your Cyrex rep, get to know them because they are really invaluable as well. And then, you know, if you look at my name, I'm on Instagram, Robin Puglia. So I'm on Instagram. That's the name of my website. All of those will come up as well.
Robynpugla.
Yes, that's it.
Amazing. This is how folks find you. This has been incredible. I have learned a lot. And I'm so glad that you are spending so much time teaching, because I really wish this was standard of care. It makes sense why it's not, because 20 or 30 years ago, when most of what our medical curriculum, what we learned, was being developed, there was not this focus on chronic illness. There was not this focus on complex illness. We were looking for frank pathology that we could detect and treat with the technology that existed. Mm-hmm. But we need more tools.
Yeah.
Way more tools than we learned about based on that understanding. And I am so thankful that Cyrex is developing those tools. I'm so thankful that you're teaching about them. There are already four family members of mine that came to mind that I thought, ah, you know what? My next step with them is this array. While you were talking, and I think most of us listening probably thought the same thing about patients, friends, whoever it is. I mean, autoimmune disorders are rampant, but beyond that, immune dysfunction is at an all-time high. We've seen it post-COVID with, you know, really understanding now the way the body responds to viral illnesses and so many people who just seem like they can't ever recover. There's a lot we can do to detect what's going on at a root cause level and to help them. I'm glad you're doing this work. Seriously, thank you. The impact is amazing. Like every clinician you educate can go 1,000x that impact that you would have had if you were just one-on-one clinical practice. I'm so glad that you're doing education. So thank you, Robin, for being our expert today, and we'll have you back soon.
It is an absolute pleasure. If I can leave you with a final immunology joke about practitioner education, it is that I had this moment. I was teaching a deep dive. So it was 3 hours on the immune system followed by 10 hours on autoimmunity specifically. It was being recorded. So I was standing and doing these lectures over 3 days. And at the end of that, I really had this moment of, oh, I understand. I am an antigen presenting cell. So my whole...
That is such a deep cut joke.
It's how my brain works, is to take all of that info and then distill it down and present it to the practitioners. Here's what you need to know.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, now you need that very clearly behind you. Like a little antigen. Yourself. I mean, kind of, yeah. That's so fantastic. I love that. And it's never going to leave my brain. We need t-shirts for you, a mug. Thank you for being here today.
Yeah, I'm excited.
Me too. And we will see you in the next episode.
I'll see you very soon. I look forward to it. Thank you so much. And thanks everybody in the audience as well.
Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. We're so glad you're here. Before you go, we'd love your help spreading this message of whole person care. Our goal is to bring this education to more practitioners for free. And you can make a huge difference. If you liked today's episode, leave us a 5-star review. We read every single one. Drop a comment and let us know what resonated with you, or share this episode with a friend or colleague who might enjoy it. One important note, the views expressed on this podcast are those of the hosts and the guests, and they don't necessarily reflect the views of Fullscript or any affiliated organizations. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only, and it's not intended to be medical advice. For your safety, always check with your healthcare provider before making any changes to your healthcare routine. We'll catch you next time on the Root Cause Medicine Podcast.